Hello, my name is Stanley Bill. You're listening to Notes from Poland. This week I'm talking to former Polish Finance Minister Leszek Balcerowicz about the big picture for Poland's economy and politics in the age of coronavirus. We'll discuss PiS's social spending programs, its handling of the epidemic, and the opposition's chances in the next elections. NotesFromPoland.com is the leading English language source of news, insight, and analysis on Poland. In this podcast, I look at the country from all angles: politics, history, culture, and society. You can get more news and the deeper stories about Poland at NotesFromPoland.com. My guest this week is Leszek Balcerowicz, former finance minister and deputy prime minister of Poland, key author and implementer of Poland's post-1989 free market reforms, former chairman of the National Bank of Poland, and now founder of the influential think tank, the Civil Development Forum. Welcome to the Notes from Poland podcast, Leszek.
Thank you.
You're a strong critic of the economic policies, among others, of the current Polish government, led by Law and Justice. I want to get your response to some of the arguments made by the government's supporters to defend its achievements. So when PiS launched the 500-plus child benefit policy in the 2015 election campaign, many critics, including you, I believe, and including me, argued that it was unaffordable, that it would blow the budget and increase Poland's debt. 5 years later, 500 Plus is very popular and essentially an immovable part of Poland's political landscape, with all the major parties now promising to keep it. This is a huge shift in Poland's dominant economic orthodoxy. The policy has contributed to tackling poverty and lowering some measures of inequality in Poland, while budget deficits under PiS have actually been smaller than under the previous government. So can we now say with certainty that the critics were wrong and that this program is a major policy success of PiS?
I think the main points you raise are wrong. First of all, I haven't said that this is going to immediately ruin the budget. And most of the critics have not said so, first. Second, I remember pointing out that, first, the official aims of this program, and namely to increase the number of born children, are very unlikely to be achieved. And second, that one could achieve a reduction in poverty at much lower costs. And this has been proven by the research. Third, Poland is not the only country when populism, which pretty often affects the budgetary spending, turns out to be popular. But the question is the long run. And fourth, the problems which PiS have been created in Poland regarding the economy and future economic growth do not boil down only to 500 plus. Mm-hmm. But equally harmful, or even more harmful, has been the reduction in retirement age, which has increased the number of non-working Poles and reduced the growth of the number of still working people. So it's very, very harmful. And also the nationalizations of private banks, energy company, undermining the longer term efficiency of Poland's economy by increasing the scope of political influence.
I take your point.
So one should not reduce what PiS has been doing in Poland to just one point, mm-hmm, while misrepresenting it.
So you would not see any positive dimensions to the 500 Plus program and the effects, the social effects that it has had in...
You know, sensible questions, if you want to have a serious debate, is not whether you can see any positives. Because most harmful measures produce some positives. The sensible question is, what would be the better measures in order to reduce the poverty when poverty exists, and at what costs? And what is the impact, the longer-term impact of this popular measure to the longer-term prospects of Polish people, which are, as in every country, related to the prospects of economic growth.
So how do you assess this cost-benefit equation then?
Oh, very badly, and this is not my private opinion. Foh has asked the best specialist in Poland on demography and social policy to prepare a report. This was done, I think, 2 years ago, and the conclusions are very clear. First, there was no increase in the number of children which were conceived and born, as it was expected. Second, the reduction in poverty was only transitional. And third, the reduction of poverty can be achieved at much lower costs.
Through what kinds of measures, for example? Because one counter-argument to all of this would be, well, yes, it's an inefficient policy. Any policy of this kind is likely to include some inefficiencies. But nevertheless, it has achieved positive results, and therefore that it's better to have addressed in some way the growing inequalities that had previously existed in Poland rather than not to address them at all.
First of all, I don't think that one can prove that in Poland you have a growing inequality unless you compare present Poland with socialism. Second, the argument you've been using in favor of 500 plus can be also used in favor of socialism because there were some positives under socialism. Even more drastic, you can point out to some positives under the Nazi regime. This is not an argument.
That becomes a question of scale beyond any reasonable comparison.
We should avoid a certain cliché that as long as a program brings about true or under-edged positive, is it good? Because this is a pure populism.
So in your view, what would have been a more effective, more efficient, and more affordable way to tackle poverty and inequality in Poland?
Why should you focus on inequality instead of focusing on poverty, first? And second, one has to look at the sources of poverty, and then one finds out, among other reasons, the very important one, the lack of proper education, the lack of jobs. So one should focus on the reasons, underlying reasons, and not on the symptoms. And besides, there have been pretty successful, economic successful, targeted programs in Poland introduced before, which were not as expensive. Of course, they were not as popular. And in the report I have mentioned, which was published 2 years ago and was commissioned by Foh, there have been some suggestions.
For example?
For example, to look what are the main pockets of poverty and try to increase assistance. So-called pomoc społeczna in Polish has been financed in a pretty limited way. As far as I remember, it's about 3 or 4 billion zlotys compared to 40 billion zlotys regarding 500 plus. Mm-hmm. But so-called pomoc społeczna targets really poor individuals and families. So better targeting.
Okay, so if we move on to how peace has afforded this, obviously there's been a significant increase in expenditures on social programs. As you mentioned, it's of course not just 500 plus. There are also the effects of lowering the retirement age. And yet the peace government even came close to balancing the budget on one occasion. And certainly the deficits don't seem to have been bigger than in the PSL years. So how do you explain this? I mean, where have the cuts come in order for peace to keep these social spending promises?
I remember Greece before the crisis and the catastrophe was almost balancing the budget. So again, one has to look to the true figure. And we economists distinguish between so-called nominal budget deficits and structural budget deficits. And structural budget deficits are those deficits which are cleaned from the transitional impact of factors which are transitional. And in Poland, you know, what are times which are very dangerous for a country? When bad guys have good luck. Because then many people think, oh, they are very good. So in the Polish case, once peace has won elections, there was an acceleration in Poland's economic growth. But not because of peace policies, which were bad, but because of a revival, acceleration of economic growth in the European Union. which help Polish economy to grow, and second, the number of Ukrainians which came to Poland to work has doubled, and this was another important input in Poland's economic performance, and also it helped to reduce a gap, a deficit in Polish pension fund, ZUS, because some of them were paying, they were legally employed, and they were paying their dues, contributions.
Yeah, this is an interesting area in which a party that's often been anti-migrant in its policy has, of course, presided over one of the largest waves of migration in recent European history, and as you've outlined, with clear economic benefits for Poland. But when you make the comparison with Greece, I mean, are you actually suggesting that Poland is on the brink of some kind of crisis that's being hidden by transitional effects?
Not necessarily. I think the main problem which are facing, if these present policies are continued, is a slowdown in Poland's economy and a risk that we stopped catching up with the richer countries. And this has been the greatest economic achievement of Poland after 89. I was using the example of Greece to illustrate a certain fallacy, and namely that good times in the economy are not necessarily due to good policies. That you may have good times in economy and very bad policies. And this is a dangerous combination because, as I said, many people do not distinguish between good policy and good times, and they think that bad policies should continue. And then it ends always in the growing problems if not in the crisis.
I mean, if we look more broadly at this question, and obviously you are a strong advocate of fiscal discipline and of the state staying out of the market, in fact, as much as possible. But in recent times, not just in Poland, the idea of the big state has been coming somewhat back into vogue. And in the Polish case, PiS has argued that the state must play a powerful economic role because it's the only substantial domestic source of capital. But especially in the wake of the COVID-19 epidemic, other governments across the world, including some right-wing governments, are now embracing the need for state spending. Now, to some extent, that's obvious, but the emergency has perhaps reinforced a pre-existing trend that was already perceivable, inspired by larger social changes in various democracies and the success of populists. So has the spirit of the times in some way decisively shifted against the previous dominant economic liberalism, of which you are clearly a strong advocate?
Well, one has to distinguish between two sides of the economy, the supply side and the demand side. Now, the supply side is determined by the structure of the economy. Is it private or socialized? How much competition you have? How much productivity? Is by far the most important part of the economy, because in a bit longer run, the purchasing power of people depends on the quality of the supply side. And socialism, which was a destruction of market economy, has proven that. Now, if you look at the present Western countries, they are neglected the supply side, but they are not destroying the supply side. Mm-hmm. And it is only peace in Europe which engages in nationalizations of the banks, of the energy companies, and the share of the state sector, which tends to be politicized in every country, has been grown, and it's one of the largest in Europe, if not the largest, perhaps after France. So it's not true that we have a universal tendency for the socializing the supply side or destroying the market economy on the most important part, which is the supply side. What is true is that since the so-called Great Financial Crisis, which was largely due to bad policies of Fed under Mr. Greenspan and then Mr. Bernanke, there has been a shift towards trying to the more even more aggressive monetary policy, which has been named unconventional monetary policy. It consists in lowering interest rates to zero and to a central bank producing huge amounts of money which is spent on buying securities. And this policy has been continued until the coronavirus epidemics, even though it has been very much criticized by many, many reputed economists, not only me. Mm-hmm. I'm in a very good company. So I would say that this is, many economists have pointed out to the danger and risk and harms of this policy, including so-called zombification, that cheap money invites inefficiency on the part of granting the banking credit. Or if central banks print a lot of money and spend this money on buying securities, who is benefiting the most? Rich people who have more bonds or more stocks.
Yeah.
So this is a very dangerous policy, even though it has been pursued, but it is even more dangerous for a country like Poland, which don't have such a strong reputation so far like the United States on the Eurozone. So
what
I would
you,
not
make,
agree with... Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, but on the nationalization question, what do you make of Peace's argument that the Polish economy needs these large national champions, and that the only way that Polish companies would be able to compete for innovation, for instance, with companies outside of Poland, would be through the concentration of capital that only the Polish state can provide? What would be your response to those arguments?
They are not arguments. This is propaganda. We've got a lot of experience of these policies, say, in Latin America, and everywhere in the world, to huge cost and problems. Why? Because at the bottom of these pseudo-arguments lies statism, the wrong conviction that politicians and bureaucrats know better than entrepreneurs acting in the market, and that by creating huge state-owned companies, they can somehow promote economic growth. In the longer run, they destroy economic growth, and in the meantime, they engage in clientelism. They distribute jobs among the party members. This is what we've been witnessing in Poland under Peace. And also, these so-called national champions are political champions who engage not only in wasteful projects, but also in reducing media pluralism in Poland.
Yes, you're
by
referring
favoring
now to the
these big companies, yes, which have been even larger, they engage in projects which are contrary to the official propaganda of promoting economic growth. They promote the impact, political impact of one party, which is Peace, in the media. And we know that without the free media, we cannot have a well-functioning democracy.
So you're referring here to the purchase
by
Orlen of the Polish media group, the big state oil company that's purchased a media group. You see this, as many others do, as a threat to media pluralism and freedom in Poland?
Of course, but it's not only that. This is probably the most flagrant attempt. You've got also a very uneven distribution of marketing funds. You know, these companies are huge not because they are very efficient, because they have monopolistic positions, like Orlen, for example. And their marketing budget is almost half a billion Polish zlotys. And it has been shown that it is being distributed in such a way as to favor the media vassals of the ruling party.
Yes.
This is a huge scandal.
I mean, again, they argue that the same thing happened earlier, simply the other way around, that liberal media outlets received all of the advertising budgets before Peace came along, and now...
They were not presenting, to my knowledge, any data, and if they are presenting, they are probably disregarding the size of the media. You have a media which is not selling, or selling very limited number of copies, but getting huge subsidies from the taxpayers.
Shall we move on to the question of COVID in Poland? And in your opinion, how well has the Polish state handled the challenge of the epidemic? Where would you see its successes, perhaps, and failures?
Well, I am not a specialist. There are too many specialists. I don't want to compete. I can only say that I share the view that perhaps the first reaction to the first wave was too cautious, But then, when there was an election campaign, there was a false information on the part of the ruling politician, including the present prime minister, by saying that COVID is not a danger. And then again, they realized that the problem is growing, and the strategy has been chaotic, meaning that the pronouncements were not being, the promises were not being kept. I can only refer here to the official spokesman for small and medium-sized enterprises, which is a member of PiS. But he's also, I think, objective person, and he's been very, very critical of the official strategy.
So you're talking specifically here about the economic damage of the strategy rather than the particular health implications. So, I mean, where is the Polish economy placed going forward? We've seen some prognoses from international organizations suggesting that the Polish economy will suffer relatively minor effects compared to some other economies. Are you optimistic? That's very likely.
That's very likely. I'm speaking on the economic damage, which to some extent could have been avoided if there was more clarity and consistency. But if you look in a comparative way, I think I would agree with the opinions that Poland's economy is likely still to be affected, not as seriously as some other countries in Europe, for a very simple reason, which has nothing to do with their policies. We are not a tourism country. We are not Greece. We are not Italy. We are not Spain. So the sectors which suffered the most are relatively small in Poland.
Not a service-based economy so much, but either.
Especially export of services by inviting people. Mm-hmm. So this is the most important reason. And the second reason is that the private sector in Poland in manufacturing and transportation has been very efficient so far in protecting workers in their companies and their plants so that it has functioned pretty well. It was not affected by the official lockdown, and private entrepreneurs have taken care in their own interest to protect companies. And they talked to many of them. They have been very more innovative than the officials. And this explains again why Polish exports are faring pretty well so far.
What about the state itself, irrespective of PiS? Have we learned anything about the resilience of Polish state institutions in the face of this crisis?
Well, what are we speaking about when we discuss institutions?
The health
service? In the context of the pandemics. Let me say, first of all, Sanepid. So this institution which is...
So the public health.
Yeah. Now, it was too weak, and it was not strengthened enough. And this is not a question of enormous money. This is a couple of billion Polish zlotys. And it was this very important institution was chaired by seemingly very incompetent person who continued to chair it for almost a year. And this could have been avoided.
So this is again about political appointments, though, rather than the
institutions.
I would say
so. But also, it could have been strengthened financially. 1 billion zlotys for this institution would mean quite a lot if there was a competent person.
An emergency injection.
But instead, and this is, we are not speaking about 50 billion zlotys on the whole health service. I am speaking about a very narrowly defined institutions, extremely important in the context of the pandemic. But it was strengthened very to limited extent. At the same time, as you might remember, the present government has given 2 billion zlotys of taxes to the state TV. So you see their preferences. Secondly, one more point about institutions.
Sure.
The pandemic has clearly created a special situation, which has been defined in the Polish constitution, the emergency situation. So what would have been logical and normal was to announce the state of emergency. But this was not done. The special measures are not based on constitutions. They are based on laws which can be questioned from the constitutional point of view.
Yes. Some of your experts have written on that in the think tank, that essentially there isn't a constitutional basis to these laws. I mean, Peace argues that the potential costs associated with introducing a state of emergency were so huge that they were a risk to the state budget in themselves.
No, to my knowledge, because I think my experts in Fork have shown that the state of emergency would limit the liability of the state treasury.
There may well, of course, have been political reasons as well, and we don't need to get into everything that was surrounding last year's presidential elections in May. But to move on to a separate subject, which is rule of law in Poland, Peace's multiple changes to the judiciary have been met with almost universal opprobrium outside the country, where most observers view them as a threat to the rule of law. Your think tank has commented extensively on this situation. Now, Peace clearly has no intention of backing down, and the hawkish justice minister is pushing for further reforms, in fact, so we may see that ahead. But looking to the more distant future, assuming Peace loses power eventually, how can these changes then be reversed? Because this seems to me to be
already
a very complicated problem. How should a new government in the future deal with, for example, the captured constitutional tribunal or the National Council for the Judiciary? I mean, what legal mechanisms would they have? What do you think would be the best approach to unpick the constitutional mess that Poland is in?
The best approach would be to use the already existing proposals, which have been prepared by the very good lawyers, including a group which works in conjunction with Fundacja Batorego. And everybody can read it. And also we have in full, to our modest extent, we have prepared some proposals. I don't think that restoring the rule of law in Poland is a legal problem. It's a political problem in a sense that one has first to democratically remove Peace from office. And then I think it wouldn't be much problem to restore the rule of law, which should, I would like to stress, include a radical reform of the prosecution office. I understand that the attention is mostly focused on the courts as an ultimate defense, but before courts you have prosecutors. And prosecution has been captured in a shameless way by a minister, Ziobro, who should never be nominated to any legal job.
So you would separate the roles of prosecutor general and justice minister again, as they were?
This is not the most important thing. It should be done. But the most important thing is that there's an extreme concentration of power within the prosecution at the top. And as you know, Lord Acton has said it in an immortal way, every power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And you have an absolute power in the hands of a minister who is at the same time general prosecutor, and this power has been hugely misused by cleaning, so to say, the prosecution from independent prosecutors, and that by nominating people who have nothing to do with the rule of law, but they are servants of the ruling party or a junior party within the Kaczyński coalition. And this is shameless because you can prosecute innocent people for years while by ruining them their lives. And even if they are declared innocent after 10 or 15 years, their life is already ruined in most cases. So I think the number one or one of the top priorities would be radical restructuring of prosecution, which should consist of sharply reducing the power of the superior, extending the autonomy of the prosecutors, but also extending their responsibility for wrong decisions.
So you would not only separate the Prosecutor General from Justice Minister, but you would give the Prosecutor General much less power. even as an independent position, and make prosecutors more accountable in law, you're talking about? For
absolutely, they should be responsible. You know, if you ruin the life of an innocent person, you should be responsible for that. If you wrongly accuse, and if it is done on purpose, it's terrible. And we have such cases. There are some very good, competent, honest civil servants in Poland, like Wojciech Kwaśniak, who have been, in my mind, absolutely wrongly accused by prosecutors who were nominated by Ziobro. And what is the procedure? Procedure is that, say, a prosecutor who should deal with a certain politically important issue refuses. Then this case is being sent to another prosecutor, and still another prosecutor, until you find, meaning Ziobro
and
other people, a prosecutor who has been nominated by Ziobro, who prosecutes innocent people.
We have seen that this on multiple occasions, cases being shifted around in ways that seem to represent political interference.
So the possibility of shifting until you find a prosecutor without conscience should be banned. And this is on the one step in the reform of the prosecution.
If we move to PiS's future, how do you assess the current state of the ruling coalition? The cracks between the partners seem to be constantly widening, and yet it continues to hold together. What do you think will happen to PiS and its allies in the coming years, and particularly after Kaczyński steps down?
I'm not engaging in useless focus. I try to spend my time and energy to do everything possible to mobilize the public opinion on the side on rule of law and democracy. This is why I act within my think tank. I'm active in the social media.
How to do it? Because the current parliamentary opposition has not succeeded, and neither have any think tanks or NGOs succeeded in mobilizing the Polish electorate around the problem of rule of law, for example, or against what PiS is trying to do in the country. So what needs to happen?
You mean by not mobilizing, you think not mobilizing enough? But this is a difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so pay attention to the difference. But you are correct in mentioning the opposition. And obviously, there has to be an alliance of the democratic opposition, which takes time, but I think it's possible. And I think there are sufficient common grounds among the democratic opposition, and I would name the three common platform. The first would be the rule of law, which we've discussed. And every opposition party, perhaps except for so-called Konfederacja, shares the view that rule of law has been violated in Poland and has to be restored. And I don't think there would be problems in a cooperation on that. Second, the position Poland in the European Union. I think there are enough common grounds. And the third, the true separation between the church and the state in Poland. And I see an ample possibility for the agreement on these three issues, which I think is enough to create a cohesive alliance before elections.
So you're in favor of the proposal recently aired by Platforma Obywatelska, the largest opposition party, that a coalition should be established before the next elections?
Well, every sensible person in Poland that does not agree with PiS is of this opinion. And many people are trying to convince or push the members of the democratic opposition to go into this direction. Of course, this requires some, not only publicity. They have to have some informal meetings to agree, etc., before they announce it. But the most important point I want to make is that there are sufficient grounds for a coalition, because there are three hugely important subjects. Rule of law, restoring rule of law, restoring the position of Poland in the European Union, and introducing a much clearer separation between the church and the state in Poland.
I mean, the problem with that seems to me that the first two have been proven not to be sufficient to win elections. The opposition parties have been going to the elections with those two issues, and they have not managed to mobilise voters. I think the third issue is an interesting one because clearly the mood in Poland has changed since the abortion ruling and the continuing church pedophile scandals. But there's another problem, which is the arithmetic of elections is not such that you can simply add the support for parties together if they were to come into a coalition. Does it not worry you that, for example, many voters for the left would not vote for a coalition that included Platforma Obywatelska and PSL, for example, and similarly many voters for Platforma Obywatelska would not vote for a coalition that included the left, particularly in the current circumstances where there seems to be a liberalization of abortion law? Isn't there the possibility that the divisions are actually greater than that common ground that you've laid out?
You can come out with more number of pessimistic scenarios. But so what? One has to focus on the very important opportunities. And besides, I don't think one should assume that since peace has won elections recently, then the very important subjects like rule of law and European Union are not effective. There's a question, how do you present? And there's a lot of possibilities for the most important parties in Poland on the democratic side to be more professional. So not only issues, but professionalism in presenting these issues can be and should be improved.
I think certainly more could be done to present these issues in a way that makes them resonate with people.
Yes.
But the efforts to do so far have not succeeded. It's difficult to... But to come back to the election problem, it's not that people think that there shouldn't be an attempt to beat peace. It's that there is a reasoned argument that says that the parties separately can actually win more votes than they can together because of the nature of their electorates, that they won't be able to get... Turnout, as you know, is key to elections. And that turnout for a combined coalition of the opposition may suffer. And so it's therefore just that the arithmetic doesn't add up.
I know this because I have a very good contact with the best analyst of public opinion in Poland, and I understand that there may be some trade-offs. This is not sufficient to voice a sort of impossibility theorems. Why should be pessimistic all the time? Is it more interesting to the listeners?
Well, I mean, I'm not presenting it as pessimism. I'm presenting it as the way that some theorists think is the best way to beat peace, which is for the parties to go separately because they can win more votes that way.
No, but you have to have calculations. It's not enough to engage in slogans. And I know the calculations. I work with good people.
So the calculations...
So on the one hand, you have don't. On the other hand, you have risks that some voters can be passive, so you have to optimize.
My understanding is that people have different figures that they look at, and that's what the disagreement's based on. But that's useful and interesting to hear from you, that the people that you work with fall very much on the side of the coalition as the best option.
But not necessarily everybody. But again, this has to result from the calculations, and they are being made. And they are going to change with the surveys, so you have to be on the move.
A final question. We're now more than three decades on from the launch of the Balcerowicz Plan, which in simple terms ushered the Polish economy from centrally planned state socialism to capitalism and a free market. How do you now reflect on this moment in history today, and are there any things that you would do differently when you look back?
First of all, I have not dreamt, still in 1989 and the beginning, that Poland would be free to change its system. I was about to go to Britain as a visiting professor, but I was convinced to stay. And I've been very happy that I participated in something which went beyond my dreams. Poland? Free? To be free? That's the first point. And everybody who knows the history of Poland and other countries would not disagree. It's going beyond the widest dreams. Nobody, to my knowledge, in Poland still in 1989 have been saying that Poland would be the member of NATO or European Union. So this is absolutely historic. So present surprises happen from time to time in history. And the second point you raise is how one should assess developments in various countries after socialism, including Poland. This is a very simple way. Scientific comparisons. And scientific comparison looks at starting point, what were the initial conditions, what were the results, and what are the policies. And there's a lot of such comparisons, and the conclusion which has been drawn from various analysts, including the one by the World Bank 2 years ago, is that radical reforms, which means you do not wait, you move fast, you move in a broad form, brought about better results than alternative strategies, meaning delays or fragmented changes or too slow. And so far, I haven't seen any scientific analysis which would change this conclusion.
So there's nothing you would do differently?
Oh, that's a completely different sort. I would not change the strategy. You should distinguish the strategy and the details. And strategy, I repeat, was first, moving fast. Second, on the broad front, so not only stabilizing the economy, but transforming it by liberalization, by privatization. And third, trying to move fast. And I would try, what I would have changed, if possible, I would have introduced faster privatization. But there were many, there was a political resistance.
You completely reject the criticism, for example, that the privatization was too fast and too radical, and what the Prime Minister argues, that Poland's family jewels were given away.
Well, family jewels, it's a propaganda, it's not an argument. And secondly, I haven't seen any data, comparative analysis behind these statements. So one should not take them as a scientific argument.
Leszek Balcerowicz, thank you very much for talking to me today on the Notes from Poland podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.